engagement coming to a termination. "You may be able to confirm what I've said, Mr. Traddles," observed Miss Lavinia, evidently taking a new interest in him, "of the affection that is modest and retiring, that waits and waits."
"Entirely, ma'am," said Traddles.
Miss Clarissa looked at Miss Lavinia and shook her head gravely. Miss Lavinia looked consciously at Miss Clarissa and heaved a little sigh. "Sister Lavinia," said Miss Clarissa, "take my smelling bottle." Miss Lavinia revived herself with a few whiffs of aromatic vinegar, Traddles and I looking on with great solicitude the while, and then went on to say rather faintly, "My sister and myself have been in great doubt, Mr. Traddles, what course we ought to take in reference to the likings or imaginary likings of such very young people as your friend Mr. Copperfield and our niece."
"Our brother Francis's child," remarked Miss Clarissa. "If our brother Francis's wife had found it convenient in her lifetime, though she had an unquestionable right to act as she thought best, to invite the family to her dinner table, we might have known our brother Francis's child better at the present moment."
"Sister Lavinia, proceed." Miss Lavinia turned my letter so as to bring the superscription towards herself, and referred through her eyeglass to some orderly-looking notes she'd made on that part of it. "It seems to us," said she, "prudent, Mr. Traddles, to bring these feelings to the test of our own observation. At present we know nothing of them, and are not in a situation to judge how much reality there may be in them. Therefore, we are inclined so far to accede to Mr. Copperfield's proposal as to admit his visits here."
"I shall never, dear ladies," I exclaimed, relieved of an immense load of apprehension, "forget your kindness."
"But," pursued Miss Lavinia, "but we would prefer to regard those visits, Mr. Traddles, as made at present to us. We must guard ourselves from recognizing any positive engagement between Mr. Copperfield and our niece until we have had an opportunity..."
"Until you have had an opportunity, Sister Lavinia," said Miss Clarissa.
"Be it so," assented Miss Lavinia with a sigh, "until I have had an opportunity of observing them."
"Copperfield," said Traddles, turning to me, "you feel, I'm sure, that nothing would be more reasonable or considerate."
"Nothing," cried I. "I'm deeply sensible of it."
"In this position of affairs," said Miss Lavinia, again referring to her notes, "and admitting his visits on this understanding only, we must require from Mr. Copperfield a distinct assurance on his word of honour that no communication of any kind shall take place between him and our niece without our knowledge, that no project whatever shall be entertained with regard to our niece without being first submitted to us..."
"To you, Sister Lavinia," Miss Clarissa interposed.
"Be it so, Clarissa," assented Miss Lavinia resignedly, "to me, and receiving our concurrence. We must make this a most express and serious stipulation, not to be broken on any account. We wished Mr. Copperfield to be accompanied by some confidential friend today," with an inclination of her head towards Traddles, who bowed, "in order that there might be no doubt or misconception on this subject. If Mr. Copperfield, or if you, Mr. Traddles, feel the least scruple in giving this promise, I beg you to take time to consider it." I exclaimed, in a state of high ecstatic fervour, that not a moment's consideration could be necessary. I bound myself by the required promise in a most impassioned manner, called upon Traddles to witness it, and denounced myself as the most atrocious of characters if I ever swerved from it in the least degree. "Stay," said Miss Lavinia, holding up her hand. "We resolved, before we had the pleasure of receiving you two gentlemen, to leave you alone for a quarter of an hour to consider this point. You will allow us to retire." It was in vain for me to say that no consideration was necessary. They persisted in withdrawing for the specified time. Accordingly, these little birds hopped out with great dignity, leaving me to receive the congratulations of Traddles, and to feel as if I were translated to regions of exquisite happiness. Exactly at the expiration of the quarter of an hour, they reappeared with no less dignity than they had disappeared. They had gone rustling away as if their little dresses were made of autumn leaves, and they came rustling back in like manner. I then bound myself once more to the prescribed conditions. "Sister Clarissa," said Miss Lavinia, "the rest is with you." Miss Clarissa, unfolding her arms for the first time, took the notes and glanced at them. "We shall be happy," said Miss Clarissa, "to see Mr. Copperfield to dinner every Sunday if it should suit his convenience. Our hour is 3. I bowed. "In the course of the week," said Miss Clarissa, "we shall be happy to see Mr. Copperfield to tea. Our hour is 6:30. I bowed again. "Twice in the week," said Miss Clarissa, "but as a rule not oftener." I bowed again. "Miss Trotwood," said Miss Clarissa, "mentioned in Mr. Copperfield's letter, will perhaps call upon us. When visiting is better for the happiness of all parties, we are glad to receive visits and return them. When it's better for the happiness of all parties that no visiting should take place, as in the case of our brother Francis and his establishment, that is quite different." I intimated that my aunt would be proud and delighted to make their acquaintance, though I must say I wasn't quite sure of their getting on very satisfactorily together. The conditions being now closed, I expressed my acknowledgements in the warmest manner, and taking the hand first of Miss Clarissa and then of Miss Lavinia, pressed it in each case to my lips. Miss Lavinia then arose, and begging Mr. Traddles to excuse us for a minute, requested me to follow her. I obeyed, all in a tremble, and was conducted into another room. There I found my blessed darling stopping her ears behind the door, with her dear little face against the wall, and Jip in the plate warmer with his head tied up in towel. Oh, how beautiful she was in her black frock, and how she sobbed and cried at first, and wouldn't come out from behind the door. How fond we were of one another when she did come out at last, and what a state of bliss I was in when we took Jip out of the plate warmer and restored him to the light, sneezing very much, and were all three reunited. My dearest Dora, now indeed my own for ever. "Oh, don't," pleaded Dora, "please. Are you not my own for ever, Dora?" "Oh, yes, of course I am," cried Dora, "but I'm so frightened." "Frightened, my own? Oh, yes." "I don't like him," said Dora. "Why don't he go?"
"Who, my life?"
"Your friend," said Dora. "It isn't any business of his. What a stupid he must be."
"My love." There never was anything so coaxing as her childish ways.
"He's the best creature."
"Oh, but we don't want any best creatures,"
pouted Dora.
"My dear," I argued, "you will soon know him well, and like him of all things. And here's my aunt coming soon, and you'll like her of all things too when you know her."
"No, no, please don't bring her,"
said Dora, giving me a horrified little kiss and folding her hands.
"Don't. I know she's a naughty, mischief-making old thing. Don't let her come here, Dodie."
Which was a corruption of David. Remonstration was of no use then, so I laughed and admired, and was very much in love and very happy, and she showed me Jip's new trick of standing on his hind legs in a corner, which he did for about the space of a flash of lightning and then fell down, and I don't know how long I should have stayed there oblivious of Traddles if Miss Lavinia had not come in to take me away. Miss Lavinia was very fond of Dora. She told me Dora was exactly like what she had been herself at her age. She must have altered a good deal. And she treated Dora just as if she'd been a toy. I wanted to persuade Dora to come and see Traddles, but on my proposing it, she ran off to her own room and locked herself in, So I went to Traddles without her and walked away with him on air.
"Nothing can be more satisfactory," said Traddles, "and they're very agreeable old ladies, I'm sure. I shouldn't be at all surprised if you were to be married years before me, Copperfield."
"Does your Sophie play on any instrument, Traddles?"
I inquired in the pride of my heart.
"She knows enough of the piano to teach it to her little sisters," said Traddles.
"Does she sing at all?"
I asked.
"Why, she sings ballads sometimes to freshen up the others a little when they're out of spirit," said Traddles. "Nothing scientific."
"She doesn't sing to the guitar," said I.
"Oh, dear, no," said Traddles.
"Paint at all?"
"Not at all," said Traddles.
I promised Traddles that he should hear Dora sing and see some of her flower painting. He said he should like it very much, and we went home arm in arm in great good humour and delight. I encouraged him to talk about Sophie on the way, which he did with a loving reliance on her that I very much admired. I compared her in my mind with Dora, with considerable inward satisfaction, but I candidly admitted to myself that she seemed to be an excellent kind of girl for Traddles, too. Of course my aunt was immediately made acquainted with the successful issue of the conference, and with all that had been said and done in the course of it. She was happy to see me so happy, and promised to call on Dora's aunts without loss of time. But she took such a long walk up and down our rooms that night while I was writing to Agnes that I began to think she meant to walk till morning. My letter to Agnes was a fervent and grateful one, narrating all the good effects that had resulted from my following her advice. She wrote, by return of post, to me. Her letter was hopeful, earnest, and cheerful. She was always cheerful from that time. I had my hands more full than ever now. My daily journeys to Highgate considered, Putney was a long way off, and I naturally wanted to go there as often as I could. The proposed tea-drinkings being quite impracticable, I compounded with Miss Lavinia for permission to visit every Saturday afternoon without detriment to my privileged Sundays. So the close of every week was a delicious time for me, and I got through the rest of the week by looking forward to it. I was wonderfully relieved to find that my aunt and Dora's aunts rubbed on, all things considered, much more smoothly than I could have expected. My aunt made her promised visit within a few days of the conference, and within a few more days Dora's aunts called upon her in due state and form. Similar but more friendly interchanges took place afterwards, usually at intervals of 3 or 4 weeks. I know that my aunt distressed Dora's aunts very much by utterly setting at naught the dignity of fly conveyance and walking out to Putney at extraordinary times, shortly after breakfast or just before tea. Likewise by wearing her bonnet in any manner that happened to be comfortable to her head, without at all deferring to the prejudices of civilization on that subject. But Dora's aunt soon agreed to regard my aunt as an eccentric and somewhat masculine lady, with a strong understanding, and although my aunt occasionally ruffled the feathers of Dora's aunts by expressing heretical opinions on various points of ceremony, she loved me too well not to sacrifice some of her little peculiarities to the general harmony. The only member of our small society who positively refused to adapt himself to circumstances was Jip. He never saw my aunt without immediately displaying every tooth in his head, retiring under a chair and growling incessantly, with now and then a doleful howl, as if she really were too much for his feelings. All kinds of treatment were tried with him, coaxing, scolding, slapping, bringing him to Buckingham Street, where he instantly dashed at the two cats, to the terror of all beholders. But he never could prevail upon himself to bear my aunt's society. He would sometimes think he'd got the better of his objection and be amiable for a few minutes, and then would put up his snub nose and howl to that extent that there was nothing for it but to blind him and put him in the plate warmer. At length, Dora regularly muffled him in a towel and shut him up there whenever my aunt was reported at the door. One thing troubled me much after we'd fallen into this quiet train. It was that Dora seemed by one consent to be regarded like a pretty toy or plaything. My aunt, with whom she gradually became familiar, always called her Little Blossom, and the pleasure of Miss Lavinia's life was to wait upon her, curl her hair, make ornaments for her, and treat her like a pet child. What Miss Lavinia did, her sister did, as a matter of course. It was very odd to me, but they all seemed to treat Dora in her degree much as Dora treated Jip in his. I made up my mind to speak to Dora about this, and one day, when we were out walking, for we were licensed by Miss Lavinia after a while to go out walking by ourselves, I said to her that I wished she could get them to behave towards her differently. "Because, you know, my darling," I remonstrated, "you're not a child." "There," said Dora, "now you're going to be cross." "Cross, my love?" "I'm sure they're very kind to me," said Dora, "and I'm very happy." "Well, but my dearest life," said I, "you might be very happy and yet be treated rationally." Dora gave me a reproachful look, the prettiest look, and then began to sob, saying if I didn't like her, why had I ever wanted so much to be engaged to her, and why didn't I go away now if I couldn't bear her? What could I do but kiss away her tears and tell her how I doted on her after that? "I'm sure I'm very affectionate," said Dora. "You oughtn't to be cruel to me, Dodie." "Cruel, my precious love? As if I would or could be cruel to you for the world." "Then don't find fault with me," said Dora, making a rosebud of her mouth, "and I'll be good." I was charmed by her presently asking me, of her own accord, to give her that cookery book I'd once spoken of, and to show her how to keep accounts, as I'd once promised I would. I brought the volume with me on my next visit. I got it prettily bound first, to make it look less dry and more inviting, and as we strolled about the common I showed her an old housekeeping book of my aunt's, and gave her a set of tablets and a pretty little pencil case and a box of leads to practice housekeeping with. But the cookery book made Dora's head ache, and the figures made her cry. They wouldn't add up, she said. So she rubbed them out and drew little nosegays and likenesses of me and Jip all over the tablets. Then I playfully tried verbal instruction in domestic matters as we walked about on a Saturday afternoon. Sometimes, for example, when we passed a butcher's shop, I would say, "Now, suppose, my pet, that we were married, and you were going to buy a shoulder of mutton for dinner. Would you know how to buy it?" My pretty little Dora's face would fall, and she would make her mouth into a bud again, as if she would very much prefer to shut mine with a kiss. "Would you know how to buy it, my darling?" I would repeat, perhaps, if I were very inflexible. Dora would think a little, and then reply, perhaps with great triumph, "Why, the butcher would know how to sell it, and what need I know? Oh, you silly boy!" So, when I once asked Dora, with an eye to the cookery book, what she would do if we were married, and I were to say I should like a nice Irish stew, she replied that she would tell the servant to make it, and then clapped her little hands together across my arm, and laughed in such a charming manner that she was more delightful than ever. Consequently, the principal use to which the cookery book was devoted was being put down in the corner of the Jip to stand upon. But Dora was so pleased when she'd trained him to stand upon it without offering to come off, and at the same time to hold the pencil case in his mouth, that I was very glad I'd bought it. And we fell back on the guitar case, and the flower painting, and the songs about never leaving off dancing, ta-la-la, and were as happy as the week was long. I occasionally wished I could venture to hint to Miss Lavinia that she treated the darling of my heart a little too much like a plaything, that I sometimes awoke, as it were, wondering to find that I had fallen into the general fault and treated her like a plaything too, but not often. Chapter 42. Mischief. I feel as if it were not for me to record, even though this manuscript is intended for no eyes but mine, how hard I worked at that tremendous shorthand, and all improvement appertaining to it in my sense of responsibility to Dora and her aunts. I will only add, to what I have already written of my perseverance at this time of my life, and of a patient and continuous energy which then began to be matured within me, and which I know to be the strong part of my character, if it have any strength at all, that there, on looking back, I find the source of my success. I've been very fortunate in worldly matters. Many men have worked much harder and not succeeded half so well. But I never could have done what I have done without the habits of punctuality, order, and diligence, without the determination to concentrate myself on one object at a time, no matter how quickly its successor should come upon its heels, which I then formed. Heaven knows I write this in no spirit of self-laudation. The man who reviews his own life, as I do mine, in going on here from page to page, had need to have been a good man indeed, if he would be spared the sharp consciousness of many talents neglected, many opportunities wasted, many erratic and perverted feelings constantly at war within his breast, and defeating him. I do not hold one natural gift, I dare say, that I've not abused. My meaning simply is that whatever I have tried to do in life, I've tried with all my heart to do well. That whatever I've devoted myself to, I have devoted myself to completely. That, in great aims and in small, I have always been thoroughly in earnest. I have never believed it possible that any natural or improved ability can claim immunity from the companionship of the steady, plain, hard-working qualities, and hope to gain its end. There is no such thing as such fulfilment on this earth. Some happy talent and some fortunate opportunity may form the two sides of the ladder on which some men mount, but the rounds of that ladder must be made of stuff to stand wear and tear, and there is no substitute for thoroughgoing, ardent, and sincere earnestness. Never to put one hand to anything on which I could throw my whole self, and never to affect depreciation of my work, whatever it was, I find now to have been my golden rules. How much of the practice I've just reduced to precept I owe to Agnes, I will not repeat here. My narrative proceeds to Agnes with a thankful love. She came on a visit of a fortnight to the doctor's. Mr. Wickfield was the doctor's old friend, and the doctor wished to talk with him and do him good. It had been matter of conversation with Agnes when she was last in town, and this visit was the result. She and her father came together. I was not much surprised to hear from her that she had engaged to find a lodging in the neighbourhood for Mrs. Heap, whose rheumatic complaint required change of air, and who would be charmed to have it in such company. Neither was I surprised when on the very next day Uriah, like a dutiful son, brought his worthy mother to take possession. "You see, Master Copperfield," said he, as he forced himself upon my company for a turn in the doctor's garden, "where a person loves, a person is a little jealous. Leastways anxious to keep an eye on the beloved one." "Of whom are you jealous now?" said I. "Thanks to you, Master Copperfield," he returned, "of no one in particular just at present. No male person, at least." "Do you mean that you're jealous of a female person?" He gave me a sidelong glance out of his sinister red eyes and laughed. "Really, Master Copperfield," he said. "I should say Mister, but I know you'll excuse the habit I've got into. You're so insinuating that you draw me like a corkscrew. Well, I don't mind telling you," putting his fish-like hand on mine, "I'm not a ladies' man in general, sir, and I never was with Mrs. Strong." His eyes looked green now, as they watched mine with rascally cunning. "What do you mean?" said I. "Why, though I am a lawyer, Master Copperfield," he replied with a dry grin, "I mean just at present what I say." "And what do you mean by your look?" I retorted quietly. "By my look? Dear me, Copperfield, that's sharp practice. What do I mean by my look?" "Yes," said I, "by your look." He seemed very much amused, and laughed as heartily as it was in his nature to laugh. After some scraping of his chin with his hand, he went on to say, with his eyes cast downward, still scraping very slowly, "When I was but a numble clerk, she always looked down upon me. She was forever having my Agnes backwards and forwards at her house, and she was forever being a friend to you, Master Copperfield, but I was too far beneath her myself to be noticed." "Well," said I, "suppose you were." "And beneath him too," pursued Uriah very distinctly, and in a meditative tone of voice as he continued to scrape his chin. "Don't you know the doctor better," said I, "than to suppose him conscious of your existence when you were not before him?" He directed his eyes at me in that sidelong glance again, and he made his face very lantern-jawed with the greater convenience of scraping, as he answered, "Oh, dear, I'm not referring to the doctor. Oh, no, poor man. I mean Mr. Maldon." My heart quite died within me. All my old doubts and apprehensions on that subject, all the doctor's happiness and peace, all the mingled possibilities of innocence and compromise that I couldn't unravel, I saw in a moment at the mercy of this fellow's twisting. "He never could come into the office without ordering and shoving me about," said Uriah. "One of your fine gentlemen, he was. I was very meek and humble, and I am. But I didn't like that sort of thing, and I don't." He left off scraping his chin, and sucked in his cheeks until they seemed to meet inside, keeping his sidelong glance upon me all the while. "She is one of your lovely women, she is," he pursued, when he had slowly restored his face to its natural form, "and ready to be no friend to such as me, I know. She's just the person as would put my Agnes up to higher sort of game. Now, I ain't one of your ladies' men, Master Copperfield, but I've had eyes in my head a pretty long time back. We humble ones have got eyes, mostly speaking, and we look out of them." I endeavoured to appear unconscious and not disquieted, but I saw in his face with poor success. "Now, I'm not a-going to let myself be run down, Copperfield," he continued, raising that part of his countenance where his red eyebrows would have been if he'd had any, with malignant triumph, "and I shall do what I can to put a stop to this friendship. I don't approve of it. I don't mind acknowledging to you that I've got rather a grudging disposition, and want to keep off all intruders. I ain't a-going, if I know it, to run the risk of being plotted against." "You're always plotting, and delude yourself into the belief that everybody else is doing the like, I think," said I. "Perhaps so, Master Copperfield," he replied, "but I've got a motive, as my fellow partner used to say, and I go at it tooth and nail. I mustn't be put upon as a numble person too much. I can't allow people in my way. Really, they must come out of the cart, Master Copperfield." "I don't understand you," said I. "Don't you, though?" he returned with one of his jerks. "I'm astonished at that, Master Copperfield, you being usually so quick. I'll try to be plainer another time. Is that Mr. Maldon and Norseback ringing at the gate, sir?" "It looks like him," I replied, as carelessly as I could. Uriah stopped short, put his hands between his great knobs of knees, and doubled himself up with laughter. With perfectly silent laughter, not a sound escaped from him. I was so repelled by his odious behaviour, particularly by this concluding instance, that I turned away without any ceremony and left him doubled up in the middle of the garden like a scarecrow in want of support.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 19 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 20. David Copperfield, Cassette 20.
It was not on that evening, but, as I well remember, on the next evening but one, which was a Saturday, that I took Agnes to see Dora. I'd arranged the visit beforehand with Miss Lavinia, and Agnes was expected to tea. I was in a flutter of pride and anxiety. Pride in my dear little betrothed, and anxiety that Agnes should like her. All the way to Putney, Agnes being inside the stagecoach and I outside, I pictured Dora to myself in every one of the pretty looks I knew so well, now making up my mind that I should like her to look exactly as she looked at such a time, and then doubting whether I shouldn't prefer her looking as she looked at such another time, and almost worrying myself into a fever about it. I was troubled by no doubt of her being very pretty in any case, but it fell out that I had never seen her look so well. She was not in the drawing-room when I presented Agnes to her little aunts, but was shyly keeping out of the way. I knew where to look for her now, and sure enough I found her stopping her ears again behind the same dull old door. At first she wouldn't come at all, and then she pleaded for 5 minutes by my watch. When at length she put her arm through mine to be taken to the drawing-room, her charming little face was flushed and had never been so pretty. But when we went into the room and it turned pale, she was 10,000 times prettier yet. Dora was afraid of Agnes. She told me that she knew Agnes was too clever. But when she saw her looking at once so cheerful and so earnest and so thoughtful and so good, she gave a faint little cry of pleased surprise and just put her affectionate arms round Agnes's neck and laid her innocent cheek against her face. I never was so happy. I never was so pleased as when I saw those two sit down together side by side, as when I saw my little darling looking up so naturally to those cordial eyes, and when I saw the tender, beautiful regard which Agnes cast upon her. Miss Lavinia and Miss Clarissa partook, in their way, of my joy. It was the pleasantest tea-table in the world. Miss Clarissa presided. I cut and handed the sweet seed-cake. The little sisters had a bird-like fondness for picking up seeds and pecking at sugar. Miss Lavinia looked on with benignant patronage, as if our happy love were all her work, and we were perfectly contented with ourselves and one another. The gentle cheerfulness of Agnes went to all their hearts. Her quiet interest in everything that interested Dora, her manner of making acquaintance with Jip, who responded instantly, her pleasant way when Dora was ashamed to come over to her usual seat by me, her modest grace and ease eliciting a crowd of blushing little marks of confidence from Dora, seemed to make our circle quite complete. "I'm so glad," said Dora after tea, "that you like me. I didn't think you would, and I want more than ever to be liked now Julia Mills is gone." I've omitted to mention it, by the by. Miss Mills had sailed, and Dora and I had gone aboard a great East Indiaman at Gravesend to see her, and we'd had preserved ginger and guava and other delicacies of that sort for lunch, and we had left Miss Mills weeping on a camp stool on the quarter-deck, with a large new diary under her arm in which the original reflections awakened by the contemplation of ocean were to be recorded under lock and key. Agnes said she was afraid I must have given her an unpromising character. But Dora corrected that directly. "Oh, no," she said, shaking her curls at me. "It was all praise. He thinks so much of your opinion that I was quite afraid of it." "My good opinion cannot strengthen his attachment to some people whom he knows," said Agnes with a smile. "It's not worth their having." "But please let me have it," said Dora in her coaxing way, "if you can." We made merry about Dora's wanting to be liked, and Dora said I was a goose and she didn't like me at any rate, and the short evening flew away on gossamer wings. The time was at hand when the coach was to call for us. I was standing alone before the fire when Dora came stealing softly in to give me that usual precious little kiss before I went. "Don't you think, if I'd had her for a friend a long time ago, Dodie," said Dora, her bright eyes shining very brightly, and her little right hand idly busying itself with one of the buttons of my coat, "I might have been more clever, perhaps." "My love," said I, "what nonsense!" "Do you think it's nonsense?" returned Dora, without looking at me. "Are you sure it is?"
Of course I am.
I've forgotten, said Dora, still turning the button round and round, what relation Agnes is to you, you dear bad boy.
No blood relation, I replied, but we were brought up together like brother and sister.
I wonder why you ever fell in love with me,
said Dora, beginning on another button of my coat.
Perhaps because I couldn't see you and not love you, Dora. Suppose you'd never seen me at all,
said Dora, going to another button.
Suppose we'd never been born, said I gaily.
I wondered what she was thinking about as I glanced in admiring silence at the soft little hand travelling up the row of buttons on my coat, and at the clustering hair that lay against my breast, and at the lashes of her downcast eyes, slightly rising as they followed her idle fingers. At length her eyes were lifted up to mine, and she stood on tiptoe to give me, more thoughtfully than usual, that precious little kiss, once, twice, three times, and went out of the room. They all came back together within 5 minutes afterwards, and Dora's unusual thoughtfulness was quite gone then. She was laughingly resolved to put Jip through the whole of his performances before the coach came. They took some time, not so much on account of their variety as Jip's reluctance, and were still unfinished when it was heard at the door. There was a hurried but affectionate parting between Agnes and herself, and Dora was to write to Agnes, who was not to mind her letters being foolish, she said, and Agnes was to write to Dora, and they had a second parting at the coach door, and a third when Dora, in spite of the remonstrances of Miss Lavinia, would come running out once more to remind Agnes at the coach window about writing and to shake her curls at me on the box. The stagecoach was to put us down near Covent Garden, where we were to take another stagecoach to Highgate. I was impatient for the short walk in the interval that Agnes might praise Dora to me. Ah, what praise it was! How lovingly and fervently did it commend the pretty creature I'd won with all her artless graces best displayed to my most gentle care! How thoughtfully remind me, yet with no pretence of doing so, of the trust in which I held the orphan child! Never, never had I loved Dora so deeply and truly as I loved her that night. When we had again alighted and were walking in the starlight along the quiet road that led to the doctor's house, I told Agnes it was her doing. "When you were sitting by her," I said, "you seemed to be no less her guardian angel than mine. And you seem so now, Agnes." "A poor angel," she returned, "but faithful." The clear tone of her voice going straight to my heart made it natural to me to say, "The cheerfulness that belongs to you, Agnes, and to no one else that ever I have seen, is so restored, I've observed today, that I began to hope you're happier at home." "I'm happier in myself," she said. "I'm quite cheerful and light-hearted." I glanced at the serene face looking upward, and thought it was the stars that made it seem so noble. "There's been no change at home," said Agnes after a few moments. "No fresh reference," said I, "to... I wouldn't distress you, Agnes, but I cannot help asking, to what we spoke of when we parted last." "No, none," she answered. "I thought so much about it." "You must think less about it. Remember that I confide in simple love and truth at last. Have no apprehensions for me, Trotwood," she added after a moment. "The step you dread my taking I shall never take." Although I think I'd never really feared it in any season of cool reflection, it was an unspeakable relief to me to have this assurance from her own truthful lips. I told her so earnestly. "And when this visit is over," said I, "for we may not be alone another time, how long is it likely to be, my dear Agnes, before you come to London again?" "Probably a long time," she replied. "I think it'll be best, for Papa's sake, to remain at home. We're not likely to meet often for some time to come. But I shall be a good correspondent of Dora's, and we shall frequently hear of one another that way." We were now within the little courtyard of the doctor's cottage. It was growing late.
There was a light in the window of Mrs. Strong's chamber, and Agnes, pointing to it, bade me good night. "Do not be troubled," she said, giving me her hand, "by our misfortunes and anxieties. I can be happier in nothing than in your happiness. If you can ever give me help, rely upon me, I will ask you for it. God bless you always." In her beaming smile, and in these last tones of her cheerful voice, I seemed again to see and hear my little Dora in her company. I stood a while, looking through the porch at the stars, with a heart full of love and gratitude, and then walked slowly forth. I'd engaged a bed at a decent ale house close by, and was going out at the gate when, happening to turn my head, I saw a light in the doctor's study. A half-reproachful fancy came into my mind that he'd been working at the dictionary without my help. With the view of seeing if this were so, and in any case of bidding him good night, if he were yet sitting among his books, I turned back and, going softly across the hall and gently opening the door, looked in. The first person whom I saw, to my surprise, by the sober light of the shaded lamp, was Uriah. He was standing close beside it, with one of his skeleton hands over his mouth, and the other resting on the doctor's table. The doctor sat in his study chair, covering his face with his hands. Mr. Wickfield, sorely troubled and distressed, was leaning forward, irresolutely touching the doctor's arm. For an instant, I supposed that the doctor was ill. I hastily advanced a step under that impression when I met Uriah's eye and saw what was the matter. I would have withdrawn, but the doctor made a gesture to detain me, and I remained. "At any rate," observed Uriah with a writhe of his ungainly person, "we may keep the door shut. We needn't make it known to all the town." Saying which, he went on his toes to the door, which I had left open, and carefully closed it. He then came back and took up his former position. There was an obtrusive show of compassionate zeal in his voice and manner, more intolerable, at least to me, than any demeanour he could have assumed. "I have felt it incumbent upon me, Master Copperfield," said Uriah, "to point out to Dr. Strong what you and me have already talked about. You didn't exactly understand me, though." I gave him a look, but no other answer, and going to my good old master, said a few words that I meant to be words of comfort and encouragement. He put his hand upon my shoulder, as it had been his custom to do when I was quite a little fellow, but didn't lift his grey head. "As you didn't understand me, Master Copperfield," resumed Uriah, in the same officious manner, "I may take the liberty of humbly mentioning, being among friends, that I have called Dr. Strong's attention to the goings-on of Mrs. Strong. It's much against the grain with me, I assure you, Copperfield, to be concerned in anything so unpleasant, but really, as it is, we're all mixing ourselves up with what oughtn't to be. That was what my meaning was, sir, when you didn't understand me. I wonder now, when I recall his leer, that I didn't collar him and try to shake the breath out of his body. I dare say I didn't make myself very clear," he went on, "nor you neither. Naturally, we was both of us inclined to give such a subject a wide berth. However, at last I've made up my mind to speak plain, and I've mentioned to Dr. Strong that..." "Did you speak, sir?" This was to the doctor, who'd moaned. The sound might have touched any heart, I thought, but it had no effect upon Uriah's. "Mentioned to Dr. Strong," he proceeded, "that anyone may see that Mr. Maldon and the lovely and agreeable lady as is Dr. Strong's wife are too sweet on one another. Really, the time is come, we being at present all mixing ourselves up with what oughtn't to be, when Dr. Strong must be told that this was full as plain to everybody as the sun before Mr. Maldon went to India, that Mr. Maldon made excuses to come back for nothing else, and that he's always here for nothing else. When you come in, sir, I was just putting it to my fellow partner. towards whom he turned, "to say to Dr. Strong, upon his word and honour, whether he'd ever been of this opinion long ago or not. Come, Mr. Wickfield, sir, would you be so good as to tell us, yes or no, sir? Come, partner." "For God's sake, my dear doctor," said Mr. Wickfield, again laying his irresolute hand upon the doctor's arm, "don't attach too much weight to any suspicions I may have entertained." "There!" cried Uriah, shaking his head. "What a melancholy confirmation, ain't it? Him! Such an old friend! Bless your soul, when I was nothing but a clerk in his office, Copperfield, I've seen him 20 times if I've seen him once. Quite in a taking about it. Quite put out, you know, and very proper in him as a father. I'm sure I can't blame him, to think that Miss Agnes was mixing herself up with what oughtn't to be." "My dear Strong," said Mr. Wickfield in a tremulous voice, "my good friend, I needn't tell you that it has been my vice to look for some one master motive in everybody, and to try all actions by one narrow test. I may have fallen into such doubts as I've had through this mistake." "You've had doubts, Wickfield," said the doctor, without lifting up his head. "You have had doubts." "Speak up, fellow partner," urged Uriah. "I had at one time, certainly," said Mr. Wickfield. "God forgive me, I thought you had."
"No, no, no,"
returned the doctor in a tone of most pathetic grief. "I thought at one time," said Mr. Wickfield, "that you wished to send Maldon abroad to effect a desirable separation."
"No, no, no," returned the doctor, "to give any pleasure by making some provision for the companion of a child, or nothing else."
"So I found," said Mr. Wickfield. "I couldn't doubt it when you told me so, but I thought, I implore you to remember the narrow construction which has been my besetting sin, that in a case where there was so much disparity in point of years—"
"That's the way to put it, you see, Master Copperfield,"
observed Uriah, with fawning and offensive pity. "A lady of such youth and such attractions, however real her respect for you, might have been influenced in marrying by worldly considerations only. I made no allowance for innumerable feelings and circumstances that may have all tended to good. For heaven's sake, remember that."
"How kind he puts it,"
said Uriah, shaking his head. "Always observing her from one point of view," said Mr. Wickfield. "But by all that is dear to you, my old friend, I entreat you to consider what it was. I am forced to confess now, having no escape."
"No, there's no way out of it, Mr. Wickfield, sir," observed Uriah, "when it's got to this.
That I did," said Mr. Wickfield, glancing helplessly and distractedly at his partner, "that I did doubt her, and think her wanting in her duty to you, and that I did sometimes, if I must say all, feel averse to Agnes being in such a familiar relation towards her, as to see what I saw, or in my diseased theory fancied that I saw. I never mentioned this to anyone. I never meant it to be known to anyone. And though it is terrible to you to hear," said Mr. Wickfield, quite subdued, "if you knew how terrible it is to me to tell, you would feel compassion for me." The doctor, in the perfect goodness of his nature, put out his hand. Mr. Wickfield held it for a little while in his, with his head bowed down.
"I am sure,"
said Uriah, writhing himself into the silence like a conger eel, "that this is a subject full of unpleasantness to everybody. But since we've got so far, I ought to take the liberty of mentioning that Copperfield has noticed it too." I turned upon him and asked him how he dared refer to me.
"Oh, it's very kind of you, Copperfield," returned Uriah, undulating all over. "And we all know what an amiable character yours is, but you know that at the moment I spoke to you the other night, you knew what I meant. You know you knew what I meant, Copperfield. Don't deny it. You deny it with the best intentions, but don't do it, Copperfield."
I saw the mild eye of the good old doctor turned upon me for a moment, and I felt that the confession of my old misgivings and remembrances was too plainly written in my face to be overlooked. It was of no use raging. I could not undo that. Say what I would, I could not unsay it. We were silent again, and remained so, until the doctor rose and walked twice or thrice across the room. Presently he returned to where his chair stood, and leaning on the back of it, and occasionally putting his handkerchief to his eyes, with a simple honesty that did him more honour to my thinking than any disguise he could have affected, said, "I have been much to blame. I believe I have been very much to blame. I have exposed one whom I hold in my heart to trials and aspersions. I call them aspersions even to have been conceived in anybody's inmost mind, of which she never but for me could have been the object." Uriah Heep gave a kind of snivel, I think to express sympathy. "Of which my Annie," said the doctor, "never but for me could have been the object. Gentlemen, I am old now, as you know. I do not feel tonight that I have much to live for. But my life upon the truth and honour of the dear lady who has been the subject of this conversation. I do not think that the best embodiment of chivalry, the realization of the handsomest and most romantic figure ever imagined by painter, could have said this with a more impressive and affecting dignity than the plain old doctor did. But I am not prepared," he went on, "to deny, perhaps I may have been without knowing it in some degree prepared to admit, that I may have unwittingly ensnared that lady into an unhappy marriage. I'm a man quite unaccustomed to observe, and I cannot believe that the observation of several people of different ages and positions, all too plainly tending in one direction, and that so natural, is better than mine. I had often admired, as I have elsewhere described, his benignant manner towards his youthful wife. But the respectful tenderness he manifested in every reference to her on this occasion, and the almost reverential manner in which he put away from him the lightest doubt of her integrity, exalted him in my eyes beyond description. I married that lady," said the doctor, "when she was extremely young. I took her to myself when her character was scarcely formed. So far as it was developed, it had been my happiness to form it. I knew her father well. I knew her well. I had taught her what I could for the love of all her beautiful and virtuous qualities. If I did her wrong, as I fear I did in taking advantage, but I never meant it, of her gratitude and her affection, I ask pardon of that lady in my heart." He walked across the room and came back to the same place, holding the chair with a grasp that trembled like his subdued voice in its earnestness. "I regarded myself as a refuge for her from the dangers and vicissitudes of life. I persuaded myself that, unequal though we were in years, she would live tranquilly and contentedly with me. I didn't shut out of my consideration the time when I should leave her free and still young and still beautiful, but with her judgment more matured. No, gentlemen, upon my truth." His homely figure seemed to be lightened up by his fidelity and generosity. Every word he uttered had a force that no other grace could have imparted to it. "My life with this lady has been very happy. Until tonight I have had uninterrupted occasion to bless the day on which I did her great injustice." His voice, more and more faltering in the utterance of these words, stopped for a few moments. Then he went on, "Once awakened from my dream, I've been a poor dreamer in one way or other all my life, I see how natural it is that she should have some regretful feeling towards her old companion and her equal.
But she does regard him with some innocent regret, with some blameless thoughts of what might have been, but for me is, I fear, too true. Much that I have seen but not noted has come back upon me with new meaning during this last trying hour. But beyond this, gentlemen, the dear lady's name never must be coupled with a word, a breath of doubt. For a little while his eye kindled and his voice was firm. For a little while he was again silent. Presently he proceeded as before. It only remains for me to bear the knowledge of the unhappiness I have occasioned as submissively as I can. It is she who should reproach, not I. To save her from misconstruction, cruel misconstruction, that even my friends have not been able to avoid, becomes my duty. The more retired we live, the better I shall discharge it. And when the time comes, may it come soon if it be his merciful pleasure, when my death shall release her from constraint, I shall close my eyes upon her honoured face with unbounded confidence and love, and leave her with no sorrow then to happier and brighter days. I couldn't see him for the tears which his earnestness and goodness, so adorned by and so adorning the perfect simplicity of his manner, brought into my eyes. He had moved to the door when he added, "Gentlemen, I have shown you my heart. I'm sure you will respect it. What we have said tonight is never to be said more. Wickfield, give me an old friend's arm upstairs." Mr. Wickfield hastened to him. Without interchanging a word, they went slowly out of the room together, Uriah looking after them. "Well, Master Copperfield," said Uriah, meekly turning to me, "the thing hasn't took quite the turn that might have been expected for the old scholar. What an excellent man, is as blind as a brickbat. But this family's out of the cart, I think. I needed but the sound of his voice to be so madly enraged as I never was before and never have been since. 'You villain,' said I. 'What do you mean by entrapping me into your schemes? How dare you appeal to me just now, you false rascal, as if we'd been in discussion together?' As we stood front to front, I saw so plainly, in the stealthy exultation of his face, what I already so plainly knew. I mean that he forced his confidence upon me, expressly to make me miserable, and had set a deliberate trap for me in this very matter. That I couldn't bear it. The whole of his lank cheek was invitingly before me, and I struck it with my open hand with that force that my fingers tingled as if I'd burnt them. He caught the hand in his, and we stood in that connection looking at each other. We stood so a long time, long enough for me to see the white marks of my fingers die out of the deep red of his cheek and leave it a deeper red. 'Copperfield,' he said at length in a breathless voice, 'have you taken leave of your senses?' 'I have taken leave of you,' said I, resting my hand away. 'You dog, I'll know no more of you.' 'Won't you?' said he, constrained by the pain of his cheek to put his hand there. 'Perhaps you won't be able to help it. Isn't this ungrateful of you now?' 'I have shown you often enough,' said I, 'that I despise you. I have shown you now more plainly that I do. Why should I dread your doing your worst to all about you? What else do you ever do?' He perfectly understood this allusion to the considerations that had hitherto restrained me in my communications with him. I rather think that neither the blow nor the allusion would have escaped me but for the assurance I had had from Agnes that night. 'It's no matter.' There was another long pause. His eyes, as he looked at me, seemed to take every shade of colour that could make eyes ugly. 'Copperfield,' he said, removing his hand from his cheek, 'you have always gone against me. I know you always used to be against me at Mr. Wickfield's. "You may think what you like," said I, still in a towering rage. "If it is not true, so much the worthier you."
"And yet I always liked you, Copperfield," he rejoined. I deigned to make him no reply, and taking up my hat was going out to bed when he came between me and the door. "Copperfield," he said, "there must be two.